Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Gender Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Allison Lee, one of the co-hosts of the channel and assistant professor of art history at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Today, I am excited to be interviewing Kate Mann about her new book entitled How Male Privilege Hurts Women, which was published by Penguin Random House in August of 2021. Dr. Mann is an associate professor of philosophy at Cornell University, where she has taught since 2013. She did her graduate work at MIT and was a junior fellow in the Harvard Society of Fellows. She has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, and the Times Literary Supplement, and is also the author of Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny. She was recently named one of the world's top 10 thinkers by Prospect Magazine. The book we'll be discussing today is an urgent exploration of men's entitlement and how it serves to police and punish women. It offers a radical new framework for understanding misogyny and thinking about how privileged men's sense of entitlement is a pervasive social problem with often devastating consequences. Dr. Mann argues that male entitlement can explain a wide array of phenomena, from mansplaining and the undertreatment of women's pain, to mass shootings by incels, and the seemingly intractable notion that women are unelectable. With wit and true intellectual fierceness, Dr. Mann sheds new light on important dimensions of gender and power, and offers a vision of a world in which women are just as entitled as men to our collective care and concern. I am thrilled to get to discuss this book with its author today, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Kate Mann, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Absolutely. Well, I wonder if we might begin before we dive into the book itself, and have you speak a little bit about yourself, just where you were born, where you attended graduate school, how you came to be at Cornell, if maybe there's an interesting story there. Just give us some of your background, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up about an hour northeast of Melbourne in Victoria, Australia. So yes, I'm Australian by birth, as might be revealed by my accent. I had a lovely childhood in really the countryside. We had kangaroos roaming around and a couple of ponies and horses and chickens. It's a very rural area. And then after high school, where I suppose I should say that part of my interest in misogyny came from the fact that I attended an all-boys high school as one of the first three girls the year the school integrated. That was for my final 2 years of high school, so that was an interesting experience, to say the least. But after that, I went to Melbourne University as an undergrad and studied philosophy and computer science. And I then went on to grad school at MIT in philosophy, working with Sally Haslanger and Ray Langton, Richard Holton, Julia Markovits. I was lucky enough to be offered the job at Cornell in my final year of grad school, and it was a wonderful department, wonderful area to live in. I wanted to kind of stay true to my roots and live somewhere that had a countryside. So it's a wonderful place to get to live for the last now 8 years.
Well, that all makes sense. I have to give like a little shout out. Some background I remember hearing because Kate actually did an interview about Down Girl with the New Books Network. So a little bit of a shout out. If you enjoy the interview today, be sure to check out the other episode that doesn't have me as the host, but gives a little bit more on this background. I always think too of schools that, you know, take a long time to be integrated or have a history of being all boys schools, because my mom, shout out to my Navy captain mom, taught for a time at Virginia Military Institute, not when it was all boys, but once it had been integrated. And I've talked to her a lot about some of the issues that I know you faced from listening to other interviews with you. So I didn't know about the computer science and philosophy, though. This is an interesting little twist. I'm sure we could talk more about it. But maybe I could ask you, since you already started getting us a little bit of the way into why you work on what you do, to say something about, or something more about, how you became interested in studying misogyny, or maybe how you came to have the interest in feminist philosophy that you do, and then maybe more specifically, how you came to write and title the book that we're talking about today.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose as an undergrad, I was most interested in logic and the more technical aspects of philosophy. That led to my interest in computer science as sort of a supplement to my logic studies. But it wasn't until grad school, when I was at MIT, that I really became, I had a sense of freedom to pursue a long-standing interest in feminist theory and feminist philosophy that had always been something I was passionately interested in, but hadn't necessarily thought of as a viable career path within philosophy before the kind of tutelage and mentorship of Sally Haslinger. And I remember her saying to a group of us in the lounge one day that sometimes women in philosophy are particularly attracted to studying logic or history because there's a proof or a text. And so it's in some ways harder to be wrong and to just have to defend your views against vigorous disagreement because you can actually demonstrably be correct. And that had a big effect on me hearing that, because I wondered if I was doing logic for some of the wrong reasons. So I was very interested in it, but I also wondered if I was shutting off a part of myself that was interested in things like ethics and feminist concerns because I kind of wanted to be right rather than have to make the argument. That kind of occasioned a shift for me into ethics and feminist thought. But I wrote my dissertation really in moral philosophy. And it wasn't until my first year of teaching at Cornell that I got interested in misogyny as a topic. And I would say what made me really obsessed with the topic of misogyny was the very last few days of my first semester, or first year of teaching, I should say, the Isla Vista killings happened. So Elliot Rodger struck in Isla Vista, California, and he had planned to kill a whole sorority house full of women, ended up killing two and wounding one woman in the house that he had targeted a house and ended up killing students in a nearby sorority. And he also murdered three young men that day. So these horribly tragic events. But what interested me as a philosopher was the fact that there was so much denial in the media that this was misogyny.
Yes.
Even though he had an intent on slaying a whole sorority house full of women, the age and genre of my students. So I suppose the combination of feeling a special responsibility as a new faculty member to female students and worrying about the things like sexual assault, sexual harassment, and, for that matter, misogynistic murder, those kind of factors coalesced together with the media denial that this was a misogynistic string of murders to make me really want to dig into what misogyny was. And so that really led to a big change in my interest, and I became, I said obsessed, and I think that's accurate, with writing and thinking about misogyny, and really spent the next 4 years working on the book that became Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, my first book. And that came out late in 2017. It actually came out the week the Me Too movement was popularized by various celebrities after having, of course, been led by Tarana Burke for over a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And so that meant the book got a lot more press than I had been expecting or had anticipated or had hoped for even. And it was really a year later, during September of 2018, that the next book had its genesis, when the Kavanaugh hearings happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it was hearing Brett Kavanaugh's entitled, furious, and somewhat stroppy, fulminating about his being questioned about the accusations against him by Christine Blasey Ford, that he'd been someone who had sexually assaulted her when the two were both in high school. Hearing his sense of angry entitlement to not be questioned over those very credible accusations led to me thinking that there was something really worth exploring here, to dig into specifically the topic of white male entitlement and the way that it is connected with misogyny. So that's how the second book came to pass.
Well, there's so many things that I want to latch onto and follow up about. I think one of the things I'm always so struck about with your work, maybe as distinctive within philosophy too, is how interwoven constantly these contemporary events, these things that are in the news media, these things that I think for the most part, at least here in America, we're all very aware of as they're happening. And you're right, you know, absolutely, that the media covers them in ways that are sometimes disappointing or sometimes problematic for those of us who think really deeply about gender and power. And maybe think, you know, with a feminist lens as scholars in all these various fields. But it packs such a punch to read both of your books now. You know, I read Down Girl and now I read Entitled to talk to you about it today. And I'm just always so struck by the relevance. I mean, it's right here. It's not some distant problem. It's not some thought experiment. It is absolutely central that the way that you're thinking about entitlement, the way you're thinking about misogyny, is in terms of things we can all really latch onto and interpret in various ways. You know, some people watched the Kavanaugh hearings and didn't think that that was a sign of his entitlement, or had all sorts of explanations for his behavior and ways of defending him, which you talk about. But I don't know, I'm glad that you mentioned that, and I can sort of plug the book in terms of emphasizing that it does do that so thoroughly. And it's a very different kind of philosophy that gets produced because you do that. I wondered if I might, since you've been mentioning Down Girl and talking about first book versus second book, and I'm glad you mentioned too that you maybe weren't expecting that it would get wrapped up in the Me Too movement and how intense that moment was in culture, let's say, in politics. But can we talk a little bit about the differences between these books? I kept thinking in advance of getting ready to talk to you, do I talk about this at the beginning or at the end? And I think it's coming up now, so maybe we talk about it now. But having read both, I was struck by how different the tone, maybe, or the style. I kept thinking, how do I describe the difference between these two books? And it's something you do address in the final chapter, actually. You kind of come out and really directly speak to the ways that these books are different. But I wonder if I might draw out a little bit, you know, that this book just feels so much lighter. I feel like this, it's going to sound not how I want it to, but it's much more readable than Down Girl. Mm-hmm. Down Girl wasn't as intense, and this book, Entitled, is intense too, but in a totally different way. Will you speak a little bit about the differences between these? And if the personal needs to come up here, you're welcome to speak to that too, because it's something you're very forthcoming about in the book.
Yeah, I so appreciate that question because they are such different flavors of books.
Yeah.
And part of that, of course, is pragmatic. So Down Girl is a book that I wrote before I was tenured, and so I had to think about it as an academic work as well as it was marketed as a crossover book. So it was a book that was meant to be a fairly readable academic work. But whereas Entitled was written for a trade publisher, Crown, as well as Penguin UK, and so it had to be written with a much more popular and accessible style and reader in mind. And that was partly intentional because while the first book was meant to be part of my tenure file, the second book I wanted to be for all those people who said they were interested in the subject matter of Down Girl but couldn't really get past some of the academic prose. Maybe they could, but they couldn't give it to their teenage daughter who they thought would benefit from reading something along these lines. So I wrote it hoping that philosophers and academics would be interested in it too, but that it could reach a wider audience. But that's just the sort of surface level stuff about genre. I mean, the deeper part of it is that I was really in a lot of despair when I wrote Down Girl. I was writing it as someone who expected to be silenced. And I was writing it as someone who felt like the very act of writing this book was highly illicit according to its content. That being an outspoken feminist as a woman and as a woman in a fairly male-dominated profession and discipline, as of course you and many of your listeners will know, philosophy is highly male-dominated. We're at something like 15% of tenured faculty members are women, which is, I think, second only to theology in the humanities and is comparable to fields like physics and pure math. So it's a huge problem. Mm-hmm. And I felt like within my framework, what I was doing was liable to be punished, but my theory predicted that I would be in for a lot of punishment. And while there are those aspects that are true, so when I write for the popular press, you know, when I write for a larger media outlet, there is a lot of misogynistic reprisal and punishment. But I actually found that within philosophy, I think for various reasons that aren't entirely good, I didn't feel like the reception of the book was particularly punished. And I didn't feel personally subject to huge amounts of misogyny that absolutely do exist within the field. But I actually think that I, due to factors that have a lot to do with privilege and less to do with some radiant view of the field, I actually skate by pretty much fine due to things like institutional privilege, class privilege, white privilege, and their kind of intersection. So this isn't meant to be a particularly complimentary view of the field, although I think the field is improving in terms of its receptivity to work that is socially aware and politically hopefully savvy. But I think that it's more that I was able to skate by as a class-privileged white cis woman within mm-hmm. philosophy. And the other thing that happened that kind of made me less, it's partly just a story about the evolution of depression, but it's also that after I wrote Down Girl, I felt like a lot of readers reached out to me and said that the book mattered to them or that they got something out of it, even if they disagreed with large portions of it. I think I underestimated during that process the ways in which there can be real feminist community and coalition and solidarity. That those things are very real and very important and can even cut across gendered lines and be true for men, women, non-binary people, that there is a possibility that while it doesn't make me hopeful about the situation whole cloth, there is hope for finding your people. And that led me to a very different mental place when I wrote Entitled. I felt like even though there was a lot of misogynistic punishment, I wasn't as fearful I didn't feel as on the precipice of being silenced or squashed somehow. And I also felt like I had underestimated the power of feminist community that can't stop feminist backlash. In fact, it positively will engender more of it, but it's there as not a panacea, but as a welcome, healthy, salutary antidote. So that kind of awareness of being more in community, I think, stood me in good stead to a book that is still, I hope, and I think, fairly brutal in what it lays out. But I didn't have as monolithic view in writing it of what women face. It's more of a mixed bag than I think I had appreciated.
I am just so glad to hear that this feminist community did that, or, you know, arose, maybe developed itself around your book to some extent, and that you carried the work on. I don't think we academics talk enough about maybe this mixture that you were speaking to originally, the idea that, you know, we publish with university presses, like you did with Down Girl, and then realize that maybe we want to write something that's more accessible, something that they publish in, say, 10,000 copies as opposed to 500 copies, which is often the case with, mm-hmm. with some of the university presses. And that, as you said, we can give to our daughters, or we can talk about with our sisters, our mothers who aren't academics. This mixture, I think you've given such a gift, because Down Girl is a read that I agree with you that is very readable as an academic work, but has moments where it's thick with kind of philosophical discourse that aren't as acceptable. I agree with you too that Entitled, how did you put it, is brutal in what it lays out. And I mean, some chapters, gosh, I think maybe is what I want to ask you about next. In particular, and I imagine every reader is going to be struck differently. Maybe I should say a little bit. The book is structured in terms of 10 overall chapters. And correct me if I'm not characterizing it correctly, but each one is kind of a different case study of different forms of entitlement. The first chapter is called Indelible, on the entitlement of privileged men. The second chapter is Involuntary, on the entitlement to admiration. The third chapter is on the entitlement to sex, another on the entitlement to consent, and so on and so forth. And, you know, I kind of tracked my own emotional state as I read it and found that I was kind of, it was interesting which chapters affected me the most in terms of being like, whoa, that was brutal. I need a break, or, you know, I kind of had to read it more slowly because it dredged up for me as a woman, though I imagine readers who are not the same gender identity as I am would probably be struck differently by some of the material. But I found, for some reason, chapter 4, which is called Unwanted, on the entitlement to consent, was the one where I had to take a break afterwards and really think through. You talk a lot about unwanted sex within marriages in this chapter. And you discuss, quote, just how difficult it can be for a woman to resist a sense of male sexual entitlement that she or that we have internalized on our partner's or on his behalf. And something about that, I mean, it just really got me thinking, but it got me wondering too about you as the author. And you've spoken a little bit about backlash, or about what you were anticipating within your own field in terms of being silenced, being shut down, being ostracized. I mean, I think those of us who work on sexism and misogyny think about this a lot. So I wondered if I might ask, sort of, how do you cope with living with this material day in and day out? Some of what you cover in your books is just so profoundly disturbing from a human standpoint, not even necessarily from the standpoint of us as women. So can you say something about how hard it is to do this work, or make suggestions maybe to graduate students who are listening and want to do this, but don't quite know what you need to have in your toolbox to do this for years as you have?
Yes, I'd love to, because that was a big part of my journey as an author. I couldn't go back to the place in which I'd written Down Girl mentally. It was too dark. And so, I mean, a lot of the practices I implemented, again, were kind of the right thing for not necessarily all the right reasons. When I was writing Entitled, I was pregnant pretty much the whole time. And, you know, obviously a lot of the work that went into the book came before that and after it, but the actual writing process was pretty much over those 9 months.
Wow.
And so I had to be particularly careful, I felt, to kind of guard my mental health for the sake of this fetus, who's now my beautiful, delightful 21-month-old daughter. So a very strong sense of moral obligation, which to me is stronger than a sense of prudential obligation, to keep my mental health strong during that process. And what it came down to was a bunch of very pragmatic things. Not working for more than 2 hours a day, having very strict limits on how many words I would write or how many hours I would do. It was either 1,000 words or 2 hours, whichever came first. And so then spending the rest of my time doing a mixture of the administrative responsibilities that came with my job. I was actually on leave for most of the time I was writing it, which was a huge blessing and privilege. So there wasn't a ton of work that I had to do, but mostly I was engaged in self-soothing. Just things like going for a walk, making a nourishing meal, watching good bad TV, made me feel safe. And also, just pottering around the house. I would say to people who are working in these difficult areas, and my hope is philosophy is opening up to people who are doing this kind of work and who are really engaged in ways that are emotionally draining, I would say really, really look after yourself and find people too who help to look after you. I think that being compassionate towards myself was something that came pretty late in life. I think I wrote this book, I would have been 36 when I was writing this book. But it was so important, and I don't think I could have gotten through writing another book without that process of learning to take care of myself mentally, physically, and all the rest.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad that you mentioned those actual specifics. I worried that you would keep it really general. And I feel like now I have permission to watch bad TV. Oh, there's so much bad TV that I'm going to indulge in now as I work on misogyny myself. No, I we don't talk about it enough as academics or as kind of scholars, regardless of your field, this idea of learning, as you said, how to be compassionate and how to take advantage if you're on leave or something, as you said, is such a privileged thing to be able to have the space to write in this way. But it doesn't mean, listen up, everybody, it doesn't mean you write 12 or 16 hours a day, especially if your situation, as Kate was describing, is one where you have to take care of your body and your mental mm-hmm. health. And I can't thank you enough for saying what you did. I kind of want, maybe it's a good moment to talk about the way that the personal appears in this book, the way it too is threaded through, similar to, talking about Brett Kavanaugh, talking about the Isla Vista murders and so on and so forth. I wanted to read, this is just a tiny snippet from the last chapter. I like to do this because I think you have such a beautiful voice and it is such a readable book as we've been saying. And I'm hoping maybe reading a little bit of what is actually in this book will entice our listeners even more to get a copy and to read the whole thing. I'll be overlapping a little bit with what you already said, and I do have a follow-up question. So I'm not just going to read it and then leave you hanging, but this is from chapter 10, which is called Undespairing on the Entitlement of Girls. You say, quote, "I wrote much of this book while pregnant with my first child," which you already said, "and I came to feel that my previous despair had been something of a luxury I can now ill afford to indulge. I am still pessimistic about the possibility of making much needed feminist social progress without incurring destructive, toxic backlash. But giving up no longer feels like a viable option. I increasingly feel the need to keep fighting, regardless of the outcome. Hope, to me, is a belief that the future will be brighter, which I continue not to set much store in, but the idea of fighting for a better world, and equally importantly, fighting against backsliding. It's not a belief, it's a political commitment that I can get on board with. Oh, it took my breath away. I have goosebumps a little bit now rereading it. And it makes, oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for writing it. I mean, it's just, the voice is so powerful. But it also is so realistic. I don't know how else to put it. It's like, it's tempered in a way that really reveals the kind of thinker you are. But I think too, the kind of human being you are and what you really went through as you wrote this and moved through this despair. It struck me as I was kind of getting notes together for today that I feel like we know the role maybe of belief in philosophy. And I think we know pretty well the role that political commitment has often in certain kinds of philosophy. But I wondered if you might say something about what the place of hope, you know, would be in a philosophical system, or as someone like you working at very high levels of philosophy. Where does hope go amidst belief, amidst politics? You know, what's its place?
Yeah, you know, I'm someone who, I think this is an unpopular stance of mine, but I'm someone who thinks hope sometimes has to be rejected, at least as a monolithic stance.
Okay.
The idea in my first book that I still kind of stand by, for all that my mood is different, is that there is this kind of almost genre expectation of women that we should be hopeful.
Yes.
Almost like something we hold space for others to have this belief in a bright future.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see the grounds for that. You know, I look at the world in terms of, or I look, you know, especially at the moment at contemporary America, and its attempts to reckon with white supremacy and misogyny and xenophobia and classism and ableism and transphobia and homophobia, all the rest of it. And yes, there is patchy non-linear progress, and that is a wonderful thing. I absolutely believe in. So, you know, I have kind of a patchy sense that things will improve as they will, not inevitably, but because we fight for them. But to be able to say, especially as a woman or a man of color or a non-binary person, you know what, I'm not hopeful today or in general.
Mm-hmm.
And that is okay, that is justified by the evidence. And yes, I will continue to keep fighting. The philosopher Kate Norlock has a wonderful notion of perpetual struggle, that she has defended the idea that we can perpetually struggle even without hope for a kind of monolithically brighter world. But yeah, that defying of expectations to reject the knee-jerk sense that you must be hopeful regardless of the evidence as to how the future will be, that is something I believe in too.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for addressing that. It's kind of something, maybe because I'm not a philosopher. Art history is a very different field, though I like to think at least we have aesthetics as common ground. We could sort of toy around with that edge of things a little bit. But yeah, this idea of perpetual struggle without hope, I'm gonna have to think about it more. Mm. Maybe since I'm mentioning or I'm bringing up or outing myself as an art historian here, definitely an outsider in terms of I'm not in your field and I'm not technically in gender studies either, though I work on masculinity. I wondered where you see your work intersecting with masculinity studies. And maybe in particular, I was thinking a lot, I read Michael Kimmel's Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era, a couple of years ago, I think it came out in 2013. And I wondered, you know, he's kind of persona non grata right now in his own field. But he does talk about aggrieved entitlement, I think is the way that he put it. And I wondered both, you don't have to speak directly to his work, but just where do you see your work in terms of the overlap with efforts in various fields in terms of masculinity studies? Are we unified or are we all kind of working in our own little corners, shining flashlights and hoping it'll illuminate all of us together?
That's a great question, because I'm someone who really wants to draw on the work of sociologists as well as people in many other fields, historians, political scientists, art historians for that matter. I see myself as somewhat of a bowerbird who's kind of plucking shiny things from different fields, and I never care if it's philosophy. Like, sometimes philosophers have this sense of themselves as having this prestige discipline, and the question, is it philosophy, is kind of synonymous with is it good or is it interesting? And I just think that's so false, so manifestly false. So I see the kind of project of trying to illuminate masculinity, and especially white masculinity, as simply illuminated in different ways by people in different fields, but as having an important unity. Mm-hmm. And I see it as very much connected with the feminist project of understanding misogyny. So in some ways for me, these are concepts of the natural flip side of each other, because the way I think of it is there are all of these toxic male entitlements that are both felt and internalized by privileged male subjects oftentimes, and are bestowed by third parties, including oftentimes by women, entitlements to sympathy, to care, to sex, to consent, to money, to political power, to knowledge. And the way that gives rise to misogyny is that when designated givers of these goods, namely girls and women, don't supply privileged men with what they're deemed entitled to, then there is misogynistic reprisal in the form of punishment and enforcement and coercion and attempts to control, as well as sheer violence and all of these down girl moves, as I think of them, trying to get women into line in order to bestow those goods on designated privileged boys and men. Does that make sense, the way of seeing it, as in order to study these masculine entitlements, we need to study misogynistic punishment of girls and women, as well as analogous treatment of non-binary folks, analogous and worse, oftentimes, and that the whole really needs to be studied, holistically, even though, of course, different people can be honed in on different parts of the elephant. But it is the one elephant.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it not only makes sense, but it makes sense what you were saying about kind of needing to study this particular subject, to really dabble across so many different fields to put together something that's holistic. I've found absolutely the same is true. I'm a more voracious reader when I'm thinking about misogyny in terms of reading sociology, anthropology, philosophy, psychology. I mean, you kind of have to put together, I don't know, with a lot more ingredients, the meal that you're making to attack this intellectually and produce, you know, whatever your kind of angle on it is, whether it's about entitlement or about visual culture, as my work is, that I think absolutely makes a ton of sense. Maybe we can dig in now, since we're starting to talk about kind of some of the specifics of entitlement that you get into in this book. I was very struck in the chapter, I think it's chapter 8, called Unassuming on the Entitlement to Knowledge, which I have to say from the table of contents, I was like, oh, I'm looking forward to this one, because as women working in academia, you know, this entitlement to knowledge, and this chapter has a good amount on mansplaining, and I mean, it crops up occasionally, but this one in particular, you talk in this one and in a couple of others about this idea of testimonial injustice, which I think intersects with what you were just saying, and about epistemic entitlement. These are maybe some of the most kind of heady terms that you unpack, and you do unpack them beautifully in the book. I didn't feel like anything was lost on me by the end of this. Like, oh, I didn't quite understand what she meant by testimonial injustice. But can you explain these two concepts a little bit to our listeners? And then I want to ask you a follow-up question about testimonial injustice.
Yeah, absolutely. So testimonial injustice is a notion due to the philosopher Miranda Fricker, and it basically refers to moments where someone is not granted the credibility they deserve due to their membership in some minority or outgroup. So an example would be as a woman not being taken as seriously as you deserve when you testify to the fact that the Talented Mr. Ripley, Fricker's original example of this, Marge Sherwood is testifying to the fact that she suspects her fiancé, Dickie Greenleaf, has been done a mischief by the Talented Mr. Ripley, by Tom Ripley. And she has good evidence of this. Her belief is warranted. She perhaps even has knowledge of this. But her father-in-law-to-be, Greenleaf Sr., says, Marge, there's feminine intuition and then there's facts. By dismissing her as having the mere feminine intuition that something has gone wrong here when, in fact, Dickie has been murdered. So this is a classic example of testimonial injustice where someone is taken less seriously than they deserve or taken to be less credible than they deserve to be taken because, in this case, she's a woman. Now, this is linked, in my view, to a phenomenon that I've labeled epistemic entitlement, where privileged people, and I focus especially on privileged white men, they feel entitled to be the ones who issue explanations, who give information, and who represent themselves as the authority on a particular subject.
Mm-hmm.
So often this will result in mansplaining. So understood in this way, epistemic entitlement is something that will often occur independently of prior to testimonial injustice and actually goes some way towards explaining it. Mm-hmm. But his sense of entitlement to be the speaker and to be the authority will lead to him suppressing the voices of more vulnerable others.
Yeah. I was struck by sort of after you explained, similar to the way you just did, this idea of epistemic entitlement, you talk about a form of it known as testimonial smothering. And this is where a speaker kind of self-silences because they anticipate, as you say, that what they have to contribute is either not going to receive the proper uptake, or it might actually unplace the speaker or place the speaker in a kind of unsafe, maybe even risky situation to come forward and say what they want to say or what they know to be true. This made me wonder, maybe this is the most curveball or most intense question I promise that I'll ask you, but do you think testimonial smothering of this kind maybe happens for those of us scholars who work on misogyny and entitlement?
Yes. I love this question. So okay. Yes, testimonial smothering is a notion due to the philosopher Christy Dodson, and it is this powerful idea of a kind of coerced self-silencing, just as you described, where someone self-silences due to their anticipation that their words will not receive the proper uptake.
Mm-hmm.
So the way to picture it is the words are kind of on the tip of their tongue, they want to testify, but they jam them back in their mouth. They kind of eat their own words because they don't feel that they will be understood or taken aright, mm-hmm. and that there'll be something risky or even downright dangerous about this testimony. And this is actually the very first notion that I introduce in my book, Down Girl, in the introduction. And I wrote that introduction precisely because I had felt through the entire process of writing that book in danger of self-silencing. So the book opens with the example of strangulation, the literal act that is this misogynistic act of coercive control, a very common form of domestic violence that is almost invariably perpetrated by men and is perpetrated disproportionately against women, although children are also quite vulnerable to it.
Mm-hmm.
and I explore the connection between the literal act of strangulation and testimonial smothering as both ways in which women are controlled and made to eat their words rather than saying their piece. So the intro is called Eating Her Words because I have felt throughout the writing of it that I would do that, that my anticipation of the book getting horrible backlash would make me just stop and be silent.
It's such a...
And I'm sure that's true for others. I mean, I can only speak to my own experience directly, but I don't think I'm that unique. I think there is something risky, dangerous in writing about these subjects.
Yeah, and I think the fact that you sort of put it out there in the way that you do and then reiterate it again in a different way or in a slightly different context, because entitlement is the lens that you're focused on in this book, I almost think it's such important stuff for us to read, male or female, this idea that what we work on might get us in trouble. Oh, I feel like I have something important to say, but will I not get tenure if I say it in a book, you know, on this magnitude, or say it as thoroughly, as intensely, cover it as intensely as it needs to be covered? I hope, you know, students, graduate students listening and just everyday people think about this, you know, how do you counteract this kind of nasty self-silencing psychology that is so internalized by so many of us in various positions in which we don't feel entitled or we're not privileged in the way that some of the men you describe in the book so obviously are. You keep going in this chapter and talk about gaslighting, which I think is a common enough term that most people know what it is, and or maybe have seen the old movie where it's called gaslighting, where you see this actually play out between a couple. But you talk about it, as I think you should, having moral as well as epistemic dimensions, and this idea of questioning authority and challenging claims to knowledge or disagreeing on certain matters. I just wondered, again here, similar to my question about testimonial smothering happening in the disciplines that we practice in our work as scholars, are we being sort of gaslighted maybe by historiography or the power of the scholars who came before us? Are we gaslighted into believing that what we don't see in terms of misogyny, sexism, entitlement, you know, like, no, don't look over there. In my case, the artists that you're talking about weren't misogynists, you know, like it's so often reiterated, especially about artists, that, you know, oh, the personal, it doesn't intersect with the artwork that they're making. And I've begun to think about this notion of both testimonial smothering and gaslighting in terms of how that happens to us in the work we do. Do you think that happens in philosophy, or have you given thought to that?
Yes, I think it definitely happens, unfortunately. Oh. And I think you find that that dynamic so powerfully. I think one of the ways that I see my whole work and hope that my work works is by counteracting gaslighting as sort of a bulwark against the gaslighting that is a huge part of misogyny and is kind of central to the way misogyny works, is by making people feel either A, crazy, or B, guilty, ashamed for coming forward and testifying to experiences or witnessing of misogynistic actions, practices, and artifacts. I think that what often happens in philosophy is people are made to feel irrational for not buying some accepted narrative, or not buying some common intuition, or even set up framework thought experiment. But I also think, as you mentioned, there's this moral dimension to it too, where people can be made to feel, say, insufficiently sympathetic, guilty in as much as they're not extending full compassion for having the quote-unquote wrong view of a situation. So, you know, this is something that I think we really need to combat. And I have this hope that philosophy at its best could actually be something that works against gaslighting, because in a way, the spirit of gaslighting is to squash disagreement
mm-hmm.
and to squash divergences in perspectives that are threatening to the gaslighter. This is something that the philosopher Kate Abramson has brilliantly illuminated. And one thing about philosophy as a humanities discipline is that it thrives on disagreement. And I think that it's possibly one of, if not the most, disagreement-friendly practice.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of double-edged sword. It can both work to squash other perspectives, to say in a very direct way, no, that's an illegitimate perspective. Or my hope is, at its best, it can be used to open up terrain and say, isn't that an interesting divergence in how to see things? Let's explore that more. Let's view this as a useful divergence, a fruitful disagreement, and not something that has to reach premature convergence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that idea of sort of using what philosophy is innately to almost kind of weaponizing what philosophy is innately in mm-hmm. order to counteract this feeling that what you're going to want to say is irrational. And maybe going back to what you said originally in terms of the intersection between your interest in computer science and your initial interest in logic, because you want so much for to be able to prove it's true and not have people be able to take it apart, I guess you can use some of that same very rigorous logic to counteract the gaslighters, because mm-hmm. there is reality, there is truth to some extent, there are facts. Yeah. I mean, I'm a historian, there have to be facts or I'm out of a job. But you can weaponize, you can use that stuff to undermine what I see so strongly in our culture today, which is, well, I see it this way and you see it that way. And, you know, what are we going to do? Is mm-hmm. How do we ever meet in the middle? Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that's just how I see it. I think I came to philosophy for a bunch of reasons, some of them good, some of them not so good, but I stay because I think these are powerful tools that can be used to arm marginalized people. And as much as we can really genuinely diversify the discipline, which is still an open question given the conservatism and racism and misogyny that we see endemic in philosophy. But if we can do what we ought to do and diversify the discipline, these are powerful tools that can be used to really equip people to mm-hmm. powerfully resist attempts to quash legitimate perspectives that ought to be heard, that ought to be entertained, that ought to be aired.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned diversity too. It actually takes me back to what I was planning. My plan for these always just goes right out the window, because I like to respond to, you know, what you're actually saying, and I have my little notes about what I want to ask you about. But my plan to ask you sort of initially was about something that happens in chapter one and then continues to happen over the course of the book. But right from the very beginning, you say, here's another quote, "As a cisgender heterosexual white woman myself, I've benefited immeasurably from the insights of," and then you talk about scholars who are thinking about or are trying to understand the specific forms of misogyny faced by trans women, Black women in the U.S., and so on and so forth. I always, and maybe it's because I'm still untenured, I'm still a junior professor, you know, or maybe it's my field, I just always have this freak out about referring to myself in this way. And this is a trade book, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. so I think you're allowed to do this in a way that maybe, you know, if the book is with Oxford, as your first one was, you might sort of hesitate. Though I'm pretty sure you do this in Down Girl too, right? But did you have any qualms about situating yourself so firmly in terms of saying, you know, I'm cisgendered, I'm heterosexual, I'm a white woman? You know, these are qualifiers that I think are important to our perspectives, almost that we get this out of the way. Listen, this is who I am. This is the perspective I'm writing history or I'm writing philosophy from. But I wondered how that's received in your field, because in mine, it's really sort of like, oh, you don't do that. You know, like there's no reason to talk about yourself if what you're doing is empirical, if what you're doing is objective history, Allison, you shouldn't need to reveal your, you know, that you're a heterosexual white woman. It should just be like your voice is any voice. But I don't know, maybe it's a difference between philosophy and art history. Or maybe it's another one of these sort of brave things that you do as the scholar that you are. But I wondered if you just might talk about speaking from such a personal place in this book and in Down Girl. Is it difficult? How is it received? Stuff like that.
It's so interesting that you bring that up, because I think maybe philosophy has... So it's definitely not just me who does this.
Okay.
I think it's perhaps... it's certainly not a universal practice, but I do think it's common in feminist philosophy to do it.
Mm.
And to kind of straightforwardly acknowledge your positionality before moving on, which I think is, for me, it's a good way to navigate between acknowledging, I'm positioned as I am, and therefore I owe a lot to other people, other perspectives, other voices, and also I'm going to miss a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the spirit of, I'm not trying to be the last word on this topic, I'm trying to be a word on the topic. This is where you should look for gaps in my narrative and holes in my account, and places where it needs to be at the very least more richly embroidered to take into account the kind of full range of diverse women's experiences, as well as those of non-binary folks. But I think one thing that's happened in philosophy is that feminist philosophy of science has done us a huge service. Mm. So I'm thinking of people like Elizabeth Lloyd and Helen Longino and Liz Anderson, among others, many others, who have really made the argument that while there is such a thing as objectivity and intersubjective, community building within science to come up with truths that ought to be acknowledged, often our search for objectivity or a richly robust intersubjective account, those attempts can flounder on our own biases.
Mm-hmm.
So very straightforward things like people had a passive account of the role of the egg in human reproduction,
mm-hmm.
because they kind of viewed the sperm as like doing its thing and being an agent and super active and like a little man on its way to the race to the egg. Feminist philosophy of science really helped take that apart and expose the myths that had been promulgated in the name of big-ass science, because it was mostly male researchers who had very biased and fixed ideas of the feminine and the masculine,
mm-hmm.
and have missed all of these cool agentic things that eggs were apparently up to. I actually don't know exactly how that works. I think the example works well enough for my purposes that by acknowledging our positionality, we don't say, I think necessarily that we're not saying things that are generally true, but we're inviting readers to embroider, to elaborate, and also to challenge in ways that are healthy and important.
Yeah. I think I like this idea of exposing myths and like you said, so having to sort of name who you are so that others know where your biases or blind spots might be, so they can jump in and add to the work, because I'm all about that in my own work. Like, hey, I'm never going to cover this as completely, as thoroughly, from all dimensions as it should be. Everybody else jump in. And I think your work does that, where it has this flavor of like, this is what I have to say about this. Now everybody jump in, build on this from your own perspective, use this as you will. In terms of exposing myths too, I thought to ask you this maybe as the kind of last question about the book. And it's something I've been thinking to ask scholars in these interviews lately. And it's just sort of, maybe like, what surprised you the most about exploring entitlement at this depth? Mm. Was there something you just really weren't expecting to occur over the course of the research, over the course of writing it, where you're still like, wow, I didn't know it was going to go in that direction?
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. It kind of comes back to some of my roots, but this is kind of dark, and I guess I should, give a little content warning for sexual assault. What surprised me was how much sexual assault is committed by boys, mm-hmm. not men. Mm-hmm. So something we saw in the Me Too movement is a lot of the men who've been taken down by its popularization have been these men who adhere fairly well to a kind of dirty old man trope mm-hmm. that is itself ageist, problematic, has a kind of capitalist logic to it of these men being sort of past it, past their commercial viability or near enough. So, you have people like Harvey Weinstein in his late 60s, Roger Ailes in his 70s, maybe even 80s, I can't recall. But you have these older men who are the faces of the men who are taken down. But in the US, at least, between a quarter and a third of all sexual assault is committed by juvenile offenders, overwhelmingly male. And that means we have a very serious problem in how yes. boys are being taught about sexuality and what they're entitled to do and to take from girls and other boys. Because I should say that an unusually high proportion of this sexual assault, so it's still disproportionately against girls, but it's also committed quite often against boys as well, and I imagine also against non-binary kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, very concretely, I was shocked by how little we faced as a culture that boys who are, in a way, too young to fully blame or hold responsible for what they're doing are nonetheless doing terrible, violent, and hugely damaging things. I feel like we haven't fully come to grips with that as a culture because it's a very difficult problem. Firstly, there's just the practical question, how to educate people not to do this? But there's also the question of, well, how can we begin to think about these acts that, as Roxane Gay, the brilliant feminist writer, put it, they're the acts of men done by boys who are too young to be men, but they know how to do the damage of men,
yes.
how she puts it. Mm-hmm. When she's writing movingly about her own, she was raped by a group of boys when she was in her early adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a thing that has kind of stuck with me, especially as I'm now a parent thinking about how we raise children.
Mm.
How are we going to tackle? It weighs on me very heavily, and I don't know the answer.
How indeed? And, I can only think that at least part of the answer is that books like yours have been written, that they're accessible in the way that they are, that they're written in such a way that we can all latch on and really understand what's at stake here, all of the different kinds of nuances and permutations that you cover. You've done not just a service to your field, but I think a real service to all of us in terms of writing this and mm-hmm. asking us to think about this. Oh, I've taken up so much of your time. I do want to ask quickly what you're working on now or next. What can we look forward to from Kate Mann as you continue this career and this trajectory? Are you switching gears? Are you staying here? What's happening?
Yeah, thanks. At the moment, I've been really interested in gaslighting. So, kind of longer treatment of all of the, or at least some of the many areas where gaslighting is a problem, and trying to give a general definition of gaslighting, much like the definition that I gave of misogyny, that tries to understand it as a systemic phenomenon, as something that isn't necessarily interpersonal. I think it can also be political and collective. And here I've been inspired by brilliant work by Elena Ruiz, a philosopher who's written about cultural gaslighting of Indigenous women and Black women in particular by white settler colonialist culture. I'm thinking about gaslighting a lot these days. So
it sounds like such a great project. I mean, of all the things you could have said, I think I'm particularly interested for that. And if it ends up becoming a book, I will hopefully get to interview you again and talk about that work.
Well, I would love that. This has been such a joy and such a rich conversation. I'm so grateful for your wonderful, wonderful questions and your engagement and your kindness.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I just always have this list and hope that it appeals not only to the scholar that I'm talking to, but hopefully to our listeners. So get this book. I mean, I don't know what else today. I just say I've enjoyed talking to you so much. Thank you for taking the time to discuss it with me and being so open about the work and what it takes to do this work. All right, everybody, you've been listening to New Books in Gender Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Allison Lee, and I've been talking to Kate Mann about her new book entitled How Male Privilege Hurts Women. Thanks so much for listening.